The Guardian.
He actually phoned me from the space station last year on my cell phone, on my mobile, which was very exciting, and left a message. Hi, it's Mike.
Okay, I think we're ready to go.
Hello, this is Science Weekly. I'm Nell Bowes. On this week's podcast, recreating Darwin's world-shifting trip to the Galapagos.
Over 40 years after he'd returned from the voyage, he still said it was the most important thing he'd ever done. And it was so clear from that 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 was the thing that really got him excited and ready to devote his whole life to science.
From old science to the very latest, we take a closer look at Hubble.
By the end, the Hubble Key Project team came up with a much more accurate measurement for the rate of expansion of the universe. This proved for the first time that the universe was 13.7 billion years old.
And if you like that kind of stuff, you'll love this.
So if anyone wants to call the space station, it's 000000. Give it a try. Maybe you'll have better success than I did.
Plus, despite its huge influence in the evolution of the scientific method, where is Arabic science at right now?
There is still an anti-science perception. It's still perceived as a Western secular construct.
And which scientist sold out the Royal Albert Hall this week?
Regardless of whether he's saying anything profound, he is reaching out. He's getting science out there to the masses, and it captures the imagination, and I think that will always be a good thing.
I'm afraid this is an almost Alok Jar-free edition of Science Weekly from The Guardian. Welcome, I'm Nell Bowes. I seem to be in charge of science this week, but I'm not alone here. In the middle of the studio, we've got The Guardian's Ian Sample listening intently.
Hello.
Hello. And sat on my left is Dr. Karen James.
Hi, Nell.
Now, Karen's building a ship at the moment. What on earth is she doing on this highbrow science pod, I hear you ask? It's such a highbrow pod. That's because this is no ordinary boat. Karen, tell us a bit about the Beagle project.
Well, first of all, I'm not personally building the ship. I'd like to think I was that.
You haven't turned up in your overalls.
Not quite. I'm director of science for a project called the HMS Beagle Project. And we are raising money to rebuild HMS Beagle and use her for similar purposes as the original was used, sailing around the world with scientists aboard doing research and also involving young people, teachers, and using it as an opportunity to really get the message of the adventure of science across.
So Charles Darwin sailed with Fitzroy on the Beagle down in the 1830s or something.
That's right, 1831 through 1836 they sailed around, did a full circumnavigation, and mostly spent their time in South America, but went to Galapagos almost as an afterthought on the way back.
And from there we got the amazing the finches and then all the data that prompted Darwin and inspired him to start thinking about the origins of species, is that right?
That's right, though I can't quite let the finch thing go. It wasn't the finches so much as the mockingbirds in Galapagos that inspired Darwin. And I've worked a bit with Galapagos mockingbirds, so I'm a big fan. But really it was the mockingbirds and also the Falkland Island foxes and the giant tortoises that got him thinking initially. The finches came later.
So the tortoise, it was the shells after they'd eaten them, presumably, that was...
Well, he'd had reports from, I think, the governor on Floriana. The tortoises from each island had a different shape of their shell. And when he heard that, he reflected back on the Falkland Island foxes, and he reflected on the mockingbirds he was seeing. There was a different species on each island. And this is what got him started. And in his notebook between Galapagos and Tahiti, he wrote down for the first time that if this phenomenon, this kind of island-by-island species-specific forms, was a general phenomenon around the world, that it would undermine the stability of species. And that was the first time he really wrote that down, that he thought he had discovered some evidence for evolution by what he would later call natural selection.
So it's a sort of, it's an educative tool, but there will also be scientific projects running on it. Now, tell us a bit about the plans for the ship itself, because it's only, I mean, well, the original was 90 foot and had 120 people on it. I mean, it feels kind of almost extraordinary. They must have been packed in so tightly.
Yeah, and they were on there for 5 years. And you know, Darwin himself was so seasick and everything. It was must have been miserable.
Are you going to literally build another brig sloop and pack 120 people onto it? Or
Well, not quite that many people. Our plan is to rebuild the Beagle insofar as on the outside she'll look like the Beagle. Mm-hmm. But on the inside, she'll be more modern. See, we want to do scientific research aboard, modern scientific research. And so we want to be able to do that. And we also have to meet basic health and safety, you know. So it's not about recreating the actual ship as a replica. It's not really a replica project. It's about rebuilding the Beagle in a slightly more modern, updated version so that we can do science aboard, communicate, you know, back through online videos and tweets and blogs and, you know, do everything that I guess that Darwin would have wanted to do or would have done had he done this today.
Ian, you want to jump in here?
Well, I was going to ask you about whether the sort of the original plans of HMS Beagle, the sort of boat builder's plans, still exist and whether you'd be using those for the outside or whether you can just go with sort of pictures that are around from the time. But I was also wondering if you could say a little about what happened to the original HMS Beagle.
There are some plans, historical plans of the Beagle. In fact, she was part of a class of ships. So there, you know, there are plans for the other ships in the same class as well. We've partnered with a professional shipwright called Detlev Lowell, who has drawn us up some plans for the new Beagle based on the original, but also with, you know, it has diesel engines and everything and will be more modern on the inside. So we have used a combination of the historical plans and the images. I mean, even down to what colors things should be painted, and hopefully we can find a way to make the outside of the ship really, really look like the Beagle, because that's the inspiring thing. People want to see the Beagle sailing into Galapagos with scientists aboard. That's the exciting thing. We sometimes are asked, why don't you just take a modern research vessel? Well, I guess if what all you wanted to do was science, the best science possible, that's what you would do. But we're interested in combining science with education and outreach and really building enthusiasm as kind of a flagship for science. So that's why we're doing it this way. And as far as the original, the remains of the original Beagle, she's thought to be under several meters of mud in the River Roach in Essex. And there has been a project to try and establish that is, in fact, the Beagle. And there's been some research on that, including some investigations of the phytoplankton remains in the bottom of the keel to see whether they've actually got remains from South America or not, to see whether that ship that's under the mud has actually sailed around Cape Horn. And they think she has. And there's a lot of records at the National Archives to suggest that is, in fact, the Beagle. And, interestingly, in local buildings around the area, when parts were salvaged, they used them in local buildings. So if you go into, there's some buildings nearby that have old timbers from what has to be a Royal Navy ship, and so presumably is the Beagle.
Karen, I gather you're off to Galapagos soon. You're not sailing there in the ship yet because she hasn't been built, but what are you off to do there?
So what we'd like to do is use Twitter to record our most immediate experiences, blogs to record that sort of intermediate level of slightly more reflective but still diary style, and then at the end collect everything together into a collaboratively written ebook. Which all the students will write together, their version of Darwin's Voyage of the Beagle, but just for the Galapagos.
That sounds fantastic. And it's interesting using those modern-day methods of recording to reflect previous scientific practices. You're a big Twitterer, I gather,
yeah,
or tweet.
Just a little tweet. Bit.
you're going to a big tweet-up with NASA, is that right?
That's right.
What's the plan there?
A tweet up is when people who know each other on Twitter meet in real life, as simple as that. And NASA had a few of these tweet ups, and they invite a bunch of Twitter people or tweeps to attend one of their space shuttle launches. And everyone gets to meet each other for the first time and witness this amazing spectacle of a space shuttle launching. And we get to do it from the press site, which is a lot closer in. Then you would see it if you were there as a visitor Or even as a VIP, I'm told. So we get to be very, very close to the launch itself. And from previous tweet-ups, I know that it's just overwhelming and awesome, and you just, you know, it's a life-changing experience. So I'm really looking forward to that.
And how come you're involved with NASA? You've got a sponsor from NASA for the Beagle project, is that right?
It's not quite a sponsorship, but there are several links with NASA here. First of all, one of the astronauts aboard the space shuttle that's launching on November 1st that I'm going to watch is Michael Barrett. And he is an astronaut that I've met, and he is somebody who has really championed the Beagle Project. He found out about the Beagle Project by seeing a little blurb, I think, in Science Magazine a few years back. I imagine him walking into some NASA coffee room and seeing it sitting on the table and thinking, oh, what's this? But he's a keen sailor, and he has his own boat, and he was a former paleontology student. So he's got a real interest in these historical voyages of exploration, and he's kind of the modern equivalent as an astronaut of somebody that like that. So when he found out about this, he actually sent me an email out of the blue and said, I've read about your project. You know, you probably get all kinds of crazy emails, but consider this the latest. I'm an astronaut. I'll be in space this year. This was in 2009. And I'd like to work with you. At which point I just, you know, completely collapsed on the floor and sort of giggled and screamed, an astronaut. And after that, we worked together to create a formal collaboration between the Itty Bitty Beagle Project based in the UK and Great Big NASA in the US. And we have this thing called an International Space Act Agreement, which codifies our collaboration. After I got the chance to visit Houston and meet Michael Barrett, and we solidified this whole International Space Act Agreement, Mike did indeed, as he said he would, visit the space station on a long-duration space flight in 2009 from March to October. And in fact, he celebrated his 50th birthday aboard the space station. And shortly before or after his birthday, he actually phoned me from the space station. He phoned my mobile phone when I was in Brazil for a Beagle Project event, and I wasn't actually picking up, so he left a message, which was amazing. It said something like, oh, hi, this is Mike. I'm just calling to say hi and catch up, and I hope you're doing something nice, like, you know, enjoying the outdoors or maybe going down to the pub. I'm pretty sure the space station is dry, so maybe he was thinking, oh, gosh, I'd really like to go to the pub. He left a message, and then he called again, and I wasn't picking up. I wasn't getting great reception in Brazil, and he left another message. So I had all of these voicemail messages from an astronaut calling from the space station, and I listened to them repeatedly because I just thought that was really trippy, actually. And in the end, he finally called, and I was there, and I picked up. And sure enough, you know, I was having a conversation with someone on the space station, and I was so overwhelmed by that fact, I was sort of thinking, well, what do you say? What's it like up there? How's the view? You know, how do you have a conversation like that? He actually called again a few weeks later, and we had another chat, 20, 30 minutes. And the funny thing that time was I noticed that the number on my phone registered as 000000. And I thought, I wonder if you can call him back. So, of course, I hit, you know, reply, phone call, and nothing happened, unfortunately. But I tried. So if anyone wants to call the space station, it's 000000.
That's the most interesting fact we've ever had on this podcast, I think. And does that count as a long-distance call, do you think?
I don't know. I mean, think about it. The space station, when it's overhead, is only a couple hundred miles away. That's closer than calling across the Atlantic, for sure.
But if it's on the other side...
Then it's really far away. Then it's, you know, I don't know, however far, 20,000 miles or something.
I don't think that's included in my mobile price plan.
No, I don't think so. Fortunately, he called me, so... And I didn't get any special charges on my bill that month. I did look. I was thinking, uh-oh, I'm going to get some weird call received from space. That'll be a £20 fee or something.
Ian.
Yeah, I was just going to pick your brains about NASA post shuttle. November's launch is going to be the penultimate one, mm-hmm. Of the space shuttle, and then they'll be mothballed and hived out to different museums around the US. What do you think of the sort of Obama's plans for space policy, and how do you think, you know, things are going to pan out around Cocoa Beach? I mean, you go there now and the whole place is dominated by Kennedy, by all the work on the shuttle.
Well, that's a little bit of a political question, but that's okay. I'm really just sort of devastated about this end of the space shuttle program. And I think that other people who are fans of NASA and fans of space, human spaceflight, feel the same way. And previously, our hopes were that there would be a replacement program for the space shuttle. It wasn't so sad to retire the space shuttle if something was going to replace it. And they had this Constellation program, which would build new rockets and a new capsule to get humans into not only low Earth orbit, but to the moon, Mars, and beyond. I think that was their slogan. I could be wrong on that. Someone from NASA is probably listening and saying no.
Actually, everyone at NASA, everyone listens to this podcast.
But
everyone.
That was really inspiring, and it wasn't so sad at that when we thought we had that ahead of us to be excited about. And they tested the Ares rocket that would have taken the Orion capsule, and I watched that on NASA TV. It was very exciting, and it's an enormous rocket on par with Saturn V, which took the Apollo capsule. And now to learn that, well, that's not really going to happen anymore, means that this retirement of the space shuttle is just very poignant, and also, I think, devastating to the scientific community that has developed over the decades around that program. Think of all the technicians and the people who, the legacy of and the skill sets that exist to send people into space aboard the space shuttle. And if the program is retired and nothing is replacing it, what do all those people do? They leave. They have to take redundancy packages, they go do something else. And if we wait too long before having something in its place, we've lost all of those skills and all of those years and years of experience, that those people have within them. And there's actually a couple of people on Twitter who are working for NASA in their space shuttle program in various ways, and who I've been following and watching them go through decisions about when and whether to leave, and how broken up they are about it. It's really hard to see that happening.
A lot of people criticize NASA for saying it's kind of lost its way. You need somewhere to fly to, so you build the International Space Station. And people like Mike Griffin would criticize this. So the previous administrator mm-hmm. of NASA would sort of frowned on that kind of approach and said, well, why did we lose all this expertise from the Apollo program? You built Saturn V, you built all this stuff, and then just let that go to waste. Lo and behold, it looks likely to happen again. I mean, I know that there is a lot of hope to have expertise come up from the private sector, but the gap between where NASA is now and where the private sector is enormous. And I half a generation, I think, before you see anything decent coming out of private sector on that.
Yeah, I think that's right.
The Beagle Project and the educational thing surrounding it is just so inspiring. Are you a sailor? Will you be on there, the hand on the tiller?
Why else do you think I'm involved? Of course I'll be on there. But I've always, had this vision of myself one day on the decks of the new Beagle and hearing the wood creaking and hearing the sails flapping and sailing into Galapagos and, landing where Darwin landed and doing maybe, hopefully even doing some scientific research on the way.
Oh, it just sounds incredible. I have sailed through the Beagle Channel myself, but I can't imagine trying to, doing it on a replica of the Beagle. It would be just fantastic. Right. So for more information about Karen James and the project, go to thebeagleproject.com. And for more information about the TweetUp, go to nasa.gov/TweetUp. If you follow this podcast on Twitter, @ScienceWeekly, we'll let you know every time a new podcast is launched. And Karen James is on Twitter too, @KEJames. To be alerted to all the Guardian Science content, follow @GuardianScience. Still to come, we have Science in the Middle East and Stephen Hawking. But first, let's peer into the darkness with one of the most amazing pieces of technology ever created.
Science Weekly.
I'm Giles Sparrow, and I've written a book called Hubble Window on the Universe, which is a celebration of 20 years of the Hubble Space Telescope, from its launch to its latest observations. We try to focus on the latest and newest ones wherever possible. For instance, the cover image, which has been nicknamed the Mystic Mountain, is one of the latest, and I think it came out about 2 days before we went to press, so that meant a hasty change to the cover. We wanted to make it also a comprehensive book that would explain the principles of the universe from the ground up, as it were, from the solar system to the edge of the universe itself, while trying to focus on the most impressive pictures that we could get hold of. One of the most amazing things about dealing with the Hubble is that it's very much the first telescope of the internet age, and so much of the information has been put out and available over the web, so most of it is freely accessible. The telescope is about the length of a London bus, with two large solar panels on the sides which collect light. Obviously, Hubble's mainly famous for the stunning pictures that it's sent back from orbit, and these are all sent back via the tracking and data relay satellites, which is the same system that is used to keep in touch with the shuttles. It's a web of satellites that are orbiting the Earth and which can bounce signals back and forth at very high speeds. The camera works by taking a series of monochrome exposures. It doesn't have any colour sensors itself, and instead light that's entering the telescope is filtered through a series of wheels, which can filter out specific chemicals or just different bands of colour. A series of these images are sent back to Earth digitally and are then stacked together to make a full colour image back on Earth. The idea of a space-based telescope was conceived in the early 1960s, although astronomers had been aware that putting a telescope above the atmosphere would have major advantages for some time before that. Hubble itself, which was launched in 1990, is named after Edwin Hubble, the great early 20th century astronomer who discovered that the universe was expanding and confirmed that other galaxies were actually millions of light years away, far beyond the Milky Way. Up until that point, no one knew this, but he was able to use a special type of variable star called a Cepheid, which changes its brightness in a period that relates to its actual luminosity, to calculate the distance to some nearby galaxies. Another great advantage of Hubble has been that it can help us to understand planets of the solar system and keep an eye on them when there aren't space probes passing by. In 1994, Hubble was also on hand to watch a string of fragments from a huge comet called Shoemaker-Levy 9 smashed into Jupiter, letting off more energy than the combined sum of all the atom bombs on Earth. One of the most amazing discoveries of all Hubble's career came in 2008 when astronomers comparing two different images spotted a tiny little fragment that had moved, and this was the first visible light picture of a planet orbiting another star. Although Hubble's not the best instrument in the world for discovering extrasolar planets, it can be very useful once they've actually been found. For instance, there's a planet orbiting a star called HD 189733, which passes in front of its sun on occasion, as seen from Earth. By analysing how the star's light changed as the planet passed in front of it, astronomers were able to figure out the chemical components of the planet's atmosphere. The expansion of the universe and the redshifting of the light from the galaxies also means that the most remote galaxies appear red compared to those in our immediate neighbourhood. And right at the edge of the universe, there are galaxies that only shine in the infrared, but which Hubble's infrared camera, NICMOS, can pick up. The key project of the Hubble Space Telescope was to actually dissect these Cepheid variable stars in galaxies that were much further away, up to around 100 million light years from Earth. And it took eight years to do this and calibrate the measurements. By the end, the Hubble Key Project team came up with a much more accurate measurement for the rate of expansion of the universe, and therefore for how old it was and how fast it's been expanding ever since the Big Bang. This proved for the first time that the universe was 13.7 billion years old.
Science Weekly from Guardian.co.uk.
Finally, he's an esteemed theoretical physicist, author and broadcaster. Plus, he's well clued up when it comes to science in the Middle East and the influence of Islam. So clued up, in fact, he's written a book about it. Or maybe that's the reason he's so clued up. A bit chicken and egg, anyway. Professor Jim Al-Khalili popped into the studio to tell us about the golden age of Arabic science, as well as a special event he's hosting at the Royal Albert Hall. We began by asking him what drove the growth of science in the Middle East.
Islam demanded an understanding of things like astronomy, because they need to know about, you know, the times of prayer, they need to understand when to fast on Ramadan and so on. And it was also the things like working out taxes and inheritance, but those are things that all cultures share and all cultures need to have an understanding of. The real reason why it suddenly blossomed was because of an obsession among, in particular, the Abbasid dynasty in Baghdad, for getting hold of Greek texts. There was this massive translation movement for a couple of centuries where they just became obsessed with getting books and translating them to Arabic. And once they'd done that translation, that got them hooked.
Would we have lost them in the Western world if that hadn't happened, do you think?
Well, I think we would have, skipped the Arabic translations and gone straight from the Greek to the Latin. But the Islamic world, this golden age, they did more than just translate into Arabic and keep hold of it as though, keeping it warm until Europe was ready to receive it again. They advanced knowledge far more than the Greeks were ever able to go.
The beginning of your book, you are quite careful about setting up whether you're talking about people as Arabic, Islamic, Persian, and what those different things might mean. What are the issues that you're trying to address there?
I've discovered it's a bit of a minefield, just simply what to call it. So I refer to it as Arabic science. But what I mean by that is Arabic, the language, rather than the race, the Arabs. Persians get very upset, understandably, because actually probably there were more Persian great scholars than there were Arab scholars.
Well, Ptolemy was Egyptian.
Ptolemy was Egyptian, absolutely. I don't want to call it Islamic science. There's no such thing as Christian science. Well, there is, but it means something very different. There certainly isn't. Like Jewish science is something that the Nazis tried to sort of propagate to belittle the work of Einstein. So you can't name a period after the religion of those
after
who
the carried. Faith that happened
exactly.
to be going on during
Greek science. We can talk about Greek philosophy, we know what it means. Renaissance Europe, we can talk about that. But finding a name for this is difficult, and it seems that the standard definition among historians of science is to call it Arabic science, because whether they were Persians or Arabs, whether they were Christians, Muslims, Jews, they all wrote in Arabic. That was the language of the empire. It was the language of the Quran, therefore the language of the empire. And it was the lingua franca of science at
the
time.
So perhaps instead of the Renaissance, we should be talking about the Latin science that we're...
Well, yeah, even that. I mean, and today everything, the international language of science is English. We don't talk about today's science as English science, but it's difficult to find a name to define it. I don't want to give it the cumbersome name of the science carried out by the medieval Islamic empire.
Well, let's address that actually. I mean, what influence did Islam have on the work that these guys were doing? And you mentioned the Great Translation Project and the people involved. They were all Muslims. Did that have any impact at all on what they were doing, or was it just happened to be that these guys were interested in the world around them?
It did, in the sense that their faith. They learn in the Quran and from the words of the Prophet that you go and seek knowledge wherever you can find it, and it's a very sort of refreshing
celebration
view
of God.
Exactly, in a way that's very different to some Muslims today. That something is against what they read in the Quran. So Islam did have an influence, but in a way that's the Byzantine Christians and the Persians of the Sasanian Empire didn't have before them. But then there was a previous Islamic dynasty, the Umayyad dynasty, who weren't so interested in science and scholarship. So you can't just say as soon as Islam turned up, everyone wanted to do science.
I mean, it's important to tell this story just to correct, I suppose, people's perceptions that all science came from the Enlightenment. But I get the sense that perhaps you're also writing this story for modern Muslims as well, to sort of go back to a heritage that they might have forgotten about.
I get the feeling that may turn out to be the most important thing that I'm doing. I mean, I don't want to sort of suddenly sound sort of big-headed about some grand sort of quest that I'm on. Initially, it was because it was a great story to tell, and also because it's a missing part. It's not just the Islamic world's heritage. It's part of the story of how science developed that's missing. You know, there was this gap between the Greeks and the Renaissance, and it wasn't that everyone was in the Dark Ages. That was just Western Europe. But yes, I do think in the Muslim world, they're aware of these scholars and they celebrate them, but they celebrate them as great figures in history. They don't learn about them in science lessons. And I think it's something to say, look, there was a period 1,000 years ago when there was this free spirit of rational inquiry that didn't conflict with their religious faith in a way that sometimes I struggle to see in the Muslim world today.
What is the status of science in modern Islamic countries and in the Middle East today?
Well, I think it's very encouraging. I mean, they have a long way to go, but a lot of governments, in particular in the Gulf, are pouring huge amounts of money into science, sort of to the reverse of what's happening in Britain today. And they're investing, you know, billions of dollars building laboratories, research universities. But of course, you know, they have to be aware that it's more than just, there's a point I make in the book, it's more than just building shiny new equipment. You have to have the people with the freedom to carry out the science, the research, to ask questions, not to be constrained by any religious dogma. And I think there is still an anti-science perception. It's still perceived as a Western secular construct, and they're very nervous. For instance, I mean, an example is the debate on evolution theory versus creationism. While not everyone in the West, you know, is happy with Darwinian evolution, at least we've had the debates and the discussion. We haven't even had that yet in the Muslim world. So I think there's a long way to go, but there are people there who know how much of a sort of overhaul of their institutions and the way they do science and fund science, how much needs to be done yet.
And do you think that Western scientists, Western scientific bodies make enough of an effort to draw in researchers, talented researchers from Islamic countries, from places like that, so that at least they can go back to their countries and, you know, tell the world that it's not about, tell their countries that it's not about a Western ideology necessarily, but a useful thing for knowledge and for the society.
I think they do. I mean, there are plenty of exceptionally good Muslim scientists who work in the West, in Europe and the US. The problem is, if they're very good, they're going to stay in the West.
They stay there, yeah.
And it's how do these Muslim countries lure them back to head up the institutes and the research facilities there, in a way that China is doing now. You know, there are a lot of great Chinese scientists who are moving back to China because the facilities and the infrastructure is there.
Jim, you're a physicist. I can't finish without asking you about Stephen Hawking. There is a reason, obviously, though. I mean, you're going to be comparing for him at a rock star type event at the Royal Albert Hall. Just tell us a bit more about that.
Amazing. I mean, I think they've sold out. They sold all the 5,500 tickets. He's got a new book out, which I think a lot of people will know, the Grand Design. And this is a quite rare. Public lecture that he's giving, certainly at such a huge scale. He's talking about the stuff that he wrote in the book, and I'm very honoured to be standing up there introducing him.
Why is it, Jim, that to sell a science book in the volumes that he does or Richard Dawkins do, you have to mention God in some way?
They're very canny. Richard Dawkins and Stephen Hawking understand that this is what's going to capture the imagination.
Right.
And all they have to do is throw these little sort of tidbits out and media picks it up.
Did he really say that there's now no room for God? Did that really imply that he didn't believe in God before? He did believe in God before.
I don't think so. I don't think he ever did. I mean, no. I think what he'd said before was, you know, something along the lines of knowing the mind of God, which is in the same way that Einstein came out with quotes like, you know, God does not play dice. They don't mean, you know, the God of the monotheistic religions. What he's saying now is a bit stronger. He's saying that if we had a theory of everything, and he believes we're well on the way to finding one, in which case there'll be no room for God. But I don't think that's a particularly profound or new statement that he's making. But it's because Stephen Hawking said it. So everyone goes, oh no, my God, Stephen Hawking says there's no God. You know, there must be something in it.
Must have archbishops responding to that.
Exactly, absolutely.
He was talking about string theory, M theory, mm. this idea that this could explain, unify the forces and remove the need for any sort of creator, which you know, physicists have been talking about for a long time. Give us your 2 minutes on M theory. What's your sort of, do you agree with Stephen that this could be the explanation for all of the forces in the universe?
Well, it is a candidate theory of everything. It's not the only one. It's the one that gets the most media coverage. It's the one where most scientists are working in. But there are other very exotic theory. Loop quantum gravity is another one. Basically, it's finding a way of unifying the forces of nature, or finding a way of reconciling the theories of the quantum world, quantum mechanics, with Einstein's theory of relativity, the theory of the universe and cosmology. This is the big problem in physics. And we're looking for a theory of quantum gravity, and we haven't found one yet. I'm rather reluctant to say that M theory is this theory. I think we have a long way to go. It's very clever maths. It's making some interesting predictions, but we have no way yet of testing it. So I think we're a long way to go. And sometimes I wonder whether we'll ever find a theory of everything, whether we'll ever be able to reconcile quantum mechanics with relativity theory. So I'm less optimistic than Stephen.
Strong words, Jim.
There you go. Well, you know.
You can't say anything's for certain in science, surely.
When all the stuff about Stephen Hawking's new book and his pronouncement about no need for God broke, I was hauled in to do various interviews about this, and I said that M theory for me is not so different from religious faith. You have to believe it, you know, in it.
You can't test it, can you?
And therefore, it's not yet a proper scientific theory. You know, anyone can come up with ideas. It's very clever maths, but until you can test it and check that it's right or not, it's just an idea.
That's it for this week's podcast. My thanks to the author of Hubble, Window on the Universe, Giles Sparrow. My thanks to Jim Al-Khalili too. His book, The Golden Age of Arabic Science, is out now. And he's at the Royal Albert Hall this week with Stephen Hawking.
Don't forget about me, Karen James. If you want to follow along with The Beagle Project, you can visit www.thebeagleproject.com. And if you want to follow the NASA tweet up for the launch of Space Shuttle Discovery and you're on Twitter, you should follow hashtag NASA tweet up. And you can also visit nasa.gov/tweetup.
We should definitely thank Dr. Ian Sample. Thank you for coming in today. And Alok Jha, who's presumably sunning himself on a beach somewhere. Next week.
Hello, I'm Maggie Philbin. On the 21st of October, we'll be announcing the winner of the Royal Society Prize for Science Books. If you can't get along on the night, do listen to next week's Guardian podcast, when I'll be talking about why I think popular science writing is so important, and of course, what we felt about the winning book.
Plus, we're at the Amazing Meeting in London, where we'll be hearing from some pretty amazing scientists. And if you're someone who likes listening to books, we have a little treat for you. I've said too much already. Links to everything you've heard this week can be found on our blog, guardian.co.uk/scienceweekly. Leave your thoughts on the programme there, and do make sure you subscribe. This podcast was produced by Andy Duckworth.
No problem. Oh, by the way, there's an audio slideshow version of that Hubble interview with some amazing pictures. That's at guardian.co.uk/science. Sorry for interrupting. Carry on.
I'm Nell Bowes. Thanks for listening. In his bright pink thong?
You don't have what? To say that.
Honestly, I should read these things beforehand.
Not me. It wasn't supposed to be me. It's supposed to be someone else.
6,000 light years from Earth in the constellation of Serpens. Sorry, do you mind if I just stop and check that? Sure. I was bluffing. I just realised there's nothing on that page at all apart from the picture. It's in Alpha Eucis. And it was about 1,000 light years out. But what's that between friends?
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.